We'll talk with author Elizabeth Gilbert about her new book, which takes her back to her fiction roots and back in history.
Botany was the only science that was open to women because it was about plants and flowers.
Plus, planting a food forest and securing seeds for the future. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51% The Women's Perspective. I don't usually feature fiction writers on this show. There is so much news and so much to learn that there just doesn't seem to be the time. But once in a while, I read a book that is so good I just have to tell you about it. The Signature of All Things is Elizabeth Gilbert's first work of fiction since Eat, Pray, Love catapulted her to global fame. It's the story of Alma Whitaker, an educated, wealthy woman whose love of the science of botany leads her to discoveries of revolutionary scientific importance. Alma is a great character, and The Signature of All Things is a ripping good read.
I know it's not what people expect of me, but it's where I got my start, and that's something that people don't know, and I also don't really expect them to know, and it was the only thing I ever wanted to be and do with my life. And then, you know, as anybody has 10 bucks for a copy of Eat, Pray, Love knows, my life fell apart, and I used my writing over the subsequent 10 years or so to, not to explore literary invention, but to dig myself out of a hole that I had gotten into and kind of write my ship again, and to mix metaphors. And once that was done, I just wanted to return to where I came from, you know. And I also felt this sense of tremendous liberation after Committed was finished. The hardest thing I ever had to do was write the book that came after Eat, Pray, Love. And once that was done and everybody had gotten out of their system, whatever they needed to get out of their system about me, I just felt kind of invisible in the best way. I felt like nobody was expecting anything of me ever again, and that I could do whatever I wanted, and that's what I did. It was such a joy. I've never had more fun writing anything than I have writing this.
When you say Committed was so hard to write because of the expectations of you?
Yeah, and I mean, it's a very difficult position to find yourself in. I mean, first of all, let me just clarify right up front that that problem is, I think, the very definition of a champagne problem. You know what I mean? Like, let's not confuse that with an actual human problem. You know, like, let's just be very clear, you know, but within the framework of calling it a champagne problem, you know, the puzzle, I think of it more as a puzzle than a problem, was that it's difficult to begin a project knowing that whatever you do, you're inevitably going to disappoint a whole bunch of people, you know, because there's no way that I could have written a book after Eat, Pray, Love that affected people the way that book did. It was a once-in-a-lifetime thing, and I knew I couldn't repeat that. So I had to launch into a several years-long book project knowing ahead of time that the result would be that people would be disappointed in it. And that's difficult, but I felt that it was important to do it. Otherwise, I would never write another book. And that wouldn't be a tragedy for the world, but it would certainly have been a tragedy for me because I love my work. So once that hurdle was over, then I just felt like I paid all my debts. You know, the biggest homework assignment of my life was finished. I didn't owe anybody anything. Nobody owed me anything. There were no expectations in any direction. And then I could just be the most free I have ever felt as a writer. And I also have really fallen in love with my readers. I've gotten to know them more intimately because of Eat, Pray, Love, because the relationship they had with that book was so intimate. And my feeling and my desire with this book is that I want to invite them to come on this journey as well, because I wrote the book for readers, and I wrote it as a book that I hoped would delight and transport people. And that said, I don't feel any pressure on my readers or me with this, you know. If they want to come along on this journey, they are so welcome and so invited. And if they don't want to, they don't have to, because they've done so much for me already, including provide me with a life where I could do something like take 3 years and study nothing but botanical history. That's not something I would have been able to do at any other time in my life, but Eat, Pray, Love allowed that to happen. So I'm grateful for that. I mean, the whole thing just feels like zero stakes to me, to be perfectly honest.
All right, and I'm interested about who came first, Alma or Botany?
Botany. Botany came first, and I knew that I wanted to put a woman into a botanical setting. I had just started gardening and had gotten very passionate about gardening, and I knew that whatever I was going to do next was going to have to involve plants, because it was the only thing I was interested in. And once I started looking into the history of botany, I discovered that that little magic window between the end of the Age of Enlightenment and the beginning of the Industrial Revolution was the most fascinating moment in botanical history. There's just a lot of action and adventure going on there around plants. And so I knew I wanted to base the book in that time, and I knew I wanted it to be about a woman. And so I started to do research on actual female botanical researchers and explorers from that period. And while Alma is not based on anybody in particular, you know, she's informed by their lives. And I tried as hard as I could to make sure that everything she does is historically plausible, based on people who did similar things. So that's where she came from.
Well, she is a wonderful, wonderful character. And by the end of the book, I felt as though I had gone through her life with her and I knew this woman. And she was a very likable woman. But she was not an ordinary woman of her time. Was that true of the botanist that you studied?
Yes and no. I mean, the reality is, I'll be honest with you, when I initially started writing the book, my intention was to tell a story that was about a woman who had a towering intellect and fantastic ideas, but the world wouldn't listen to her because she was a woman. But once I started looking into the history of female botanical explorers and researchers, I found out that it would have been a real discredit to their memories to tell that story, because some of them were really pretty well regarded and were able to publish and were listened to. There was a woman here in New Jersey named Mrs. Mary Treat, who was a correspondent of Darwin for years, and you read the letters between them, and they are every inch the letters between two equal peers. You know, like, there's no patronizing from him. He writes to her when he needs information that only she can find, and he, you know, asks her opinion about things. And I realized it's because botany was the only science that was open to women, because it was about plants and flowers, which were sort of considered to be a woman's realm in a certain extension. So it was a science that women were able to kind of sneak into from their back gardens. and so while Alma was certainly, you know, magnificently educated, you know, there were examples of women who had that kind of education as well. So she was unusual, but she was not impossible.
How much travel and study did you have to do to make this book accurate?
I think the proper verb is get to do, not have to do. I got to do a lot of research and a lot of study. I spent about 3.5 years working on this book, and very, you know, constantly. That's all I did. That was my full-time job before I started even writing it. That was just the research. So I read hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books, not just about botany and exploration and missionaries and 19th century pornography and all the other things that show up in there, but also I read hundreds of pages of letters and diaries, because that's really where you sort of get the sound of people's voices most clearly, which helped me kind of come into the characters' minds. And then I went to French Polynesia for several weeks to make sure that the Tahitian part of the book was taken care of.
Oh, you poor woman.
I know. It was horrible. I mean, that is why I suffer. and I went to London to, it was really fun because I took my mother with me to London. My mom's an amazing gardener, and we went to Kew Gardens, and the botanical librarians there let me into their vast, magnificent herbarium, and I got to study some of Joseph Banks's letters and Darwin's notes, and, you know, all of that was very exciting. And then Amsterdam to the Hortus Botanical Garden there. So quite a bit. And again, that's another thing that I have pretty much to thank for. You know, there.
Did this story get mapped out on paper or in your head, or do you discover what happens to your characters as you're writing?
Some little aspects of it I discovered to my surprise as I was writing, but I don't know how other people do it, but there's no way I could have told a story of that scope if I didn't have it mapped out. So I had written a 70-page outline of the novel before I even began, And I needed, just for my own confidence before I started, I needed to make sure that I knew exactly what was going to happen. So, you know, there were some changes along the way as I went, but it was Alma like. It was very well. she and I have more than one similarity. It was very, very well planned before it began.
Are you already thinking about your next one, or are you taking a mental break?
I take a break in that I'm not starting to work on it yet, but I am definitely thinking about it every day, and I do want to write another novel because I had such a good time. I've come to be so fond of her, and there's really no way that anybody can convince me that she wasn't real, because she seems so real to me after having spent this many years with her, and I like the idea of bringing her story out into the world and saying, you guys need to know about this amazing person, even though she very much exists in my imagination, and hopefully will catch the imagination of readers as well.
Elizabeth Gilbert, it's been a pleasure to talk with you, and bravo, that was a really, really good read.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm glad that you enjoyed it.
Elizabeth Gilbert is the author of The Signature of All Things. Up next, alternatives to industrial agriculture, turning urban parks into intricate food systems. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1264. Across the country, communities are creating alternatives to the model of industrial agriculture and finding ways to both care for the earth and grow healthy food. One of these solutions is called a food forest, a sustainable method of growing edible plants and trees. One of the nation's largest is Beacon Food Forest in Seattle, Washington, where the urban food movement is transforming parkland 1 acre at a time. Martha Baskin has the story.
Standing in Seattle's inner-city neighborhood
wasted
of Beacon Hill,
Jackie
Kramer wipes beads of sweat from her brow and looks out
year.
At a field of volunteers bringing the food forest
food
to life.
We're standing right now in the Nut and Fruit Guild, and these are nut trees. At the base here is a clover nitrogen fixer. You can use those red blooms for a tea that's high in iron.
A cluster of plum and walnut trees show what's in store for 7 acres of deforested parkland. Trees, ground covers, and fruit-bearing shrubs are planted in proximity so they can work together as families or guilds to create beneficial relationships.
And when we look out at the food forest now, it's a bunch of young saplings. But as it grows, we'll see those trees getting bigger and more shade being cast.
What's being nurtured is a model of permaculture that combines the best of edible landscaping with the natural environment. The goal is to create an ecosystem that can sustain itself and at the same time nourish the bellies and spirits of the local community. After years of meetings between the city of Seattle and those committed to expand the locally grown urban food supply, groundwork is in high gear. At a Saturday work party, 100 volunteers show up, eager to turn Jefferson Park's dry grassland into something it may have never been. A living ecosystem of food and trees. Wheelbarrow after wheelbarrow of wood chips and cardboard are spread over the urban food grower's common enemy, grass. Raised beds are framed meticulously in urbanite, or reused concrete, for both family plots and community plots.
We want to use every bit of space we can for edible or medicinal or herbal or crafting guilds.
Glenn Herlihy is another gardener behind this inner city transformation.
We will have a certain number of 10 by 10 family plots that are for the family to raise food for their table. But where we're stretching the bounds is we're creating a food forest that's basically a public gleaning area. There's not many of those out there that really advertise that idea.
Fruit and nut trees, blackberries and gumi berries, the medium-sized shrubs from Asia gaining popularity in Western gardeners for their medicinal and sweet taste, will be free to harvest, says Herlihy. People will be trusted to harvest ethically, he explains, and only take what they need.
That's kind of what we're promoting, and that's kind of what we're challenging humanity with.
While he works, a patch of strawberries ripen in the sun, and pumpkins transition from green to mottled orange. On a bed already terraced, lavender and sunflowers beckon pollinators. As more volunteers arrive, the drummers maintain a steady beat. Deputy Mayor Daryl Smith drops by for a tour and chat. If the food forest goes according to plan, he says, it will be a new model, not just for Seattle, but for the country.
Where you can take public property and put it to good use in an area that really needs to have sustainable food.
The Beacon Food Forest is a partnership with the Department of Neighborhood's PPATCH program, who lease the land from Seattle Public Utilities, owners of Jefferson Park's western-facing grassland.
So if this helps us in the South End, more folks to have access to healthy food, and also demonstrates a new way of gardening, that's fantastic.
While the food forest takes root, another urban farmer, Christina Olson, wanted to see more immediate results. With support from the Beacon Garden Club and Rocket Community Arts, she came up with a demonstration garden she calls Beacon, a Hill of Beans, a seasonal project to introduce the wide world of beans to the neighborhood. Cross the other side of the park from the food forest, past the ball fields, and you'll see what looks like an edible apparition. Olson calls it Bean Henge.
It's actually more like a bean teepee, but we like the name Bean Henge better.
Scarlet runner beans, Italian fire tongue, calypso, and other varieties climb trellises attached to a bike spoke balanced horizontally on top of a metal pole. The opening of Bean Henge is aligned to the setting sun. Olson convinced the community center, local teens, merchants along the avenue, and the neighborhood's well-known El Centro de la Raza, or Center for the People, to join the project. For a culturally diverse neighborhood, adds Olson, growing beans in their infinite variety seemed perfect. While food forest gardeners push wheelbarrows of wood chips to cover grass, these gardeners pull buckets of water down Beacon Avenue every day to make sure the beans thrive. Volunteer Betty Jean Williamson checks beans growing on a metal fence at Dragon Auto Repair, Agate Soybeans, and Tiger's Eye.
Now they're just getting tall enough to start reaching the fence to vine up, so we have to try and train them over as they get enough length to get a hold.
As the bean vines continue to spread, the Beacon Food Forest gardeners are preparing for the fall planting, learning how to propagate more plants from existing ones and how to develop their own genetic seed bank. The biggest success story, says Herlihy, who fields calls about the food forest from all over the world, will be to create enough food for everybody.
If we really want to put our action where our words are and say we want to create a local food source that actually can actually supply a large amount of food, this has potential. This has a lot of potential just because the land is ready to grow.
2 acres are under cultivation to date, with 5 more waiting for the community's energy, vision, and spirit. Martha Baskin, FSRN, Seattle.
Wasted food is costing the world $750 billion each year. That's according to a report released by the Food and Agriculture Organization, the FAO. Deanne Penn has this report from UN Radio.
The study finds that the 1.3 billion tons of food wasted annually, which represents 1/3 of food produced globally, is also harming natural resources. José Graciano da Silva is FAO Director General.
The implication of this massive food waste for food security and sustainability is huge. If we reduce food loss and waste, we have more food available without the need to produce more and putting less pressure on natural resources.
The UN agency says with 870 million people going hungry every day, governments, farmers, the food industry, and consumers must reduce and prevent food wastage. A companion toolkit to the report contains recommendations for all stages of the food chain, including improvements in harvesting techniques, transportation, and consumption habits. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
When genetically modified wheat was found growing in Oregon earlier this year, it didn't take long for accusations to start flying. No one knew how the unapproved wheat ended up in the ground. A flurry of finger-pointing cast potential blame on a federal seed vault in Colorado, which housed the same strain of wheat. The facility's since been cleared of wrongdoing, but that led Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon to wonder just how secure is a seed vault.
I'm standing here in front of the National Center for Genetic Resources Preservation, which is just a fancy way of saying seed vault. It's a pretty nondescript building. It's beige with a red roof, 3 stories tall. But it's the nation's largest collection of seeds, genetic material for livestock and microbes. So let's go inside and see what's going on. Inside the facility, good luck getting past the lobby without a key card and passcode. Locked doors are around every corner. Luckily, I have a tour guide.
My name's Dave Dierig. I'm the research leader here at NCGRP. That's the National Center for Genetic Resources Preservation in Fort Collins, Colorado.
Dierig is in charge of the seed vault and one of the 6 people inside who has access to the main vaults where seeds and animal embryos are kept.
So, yeah, these are the doors to the vault.
We're about to head into the facility's black box storage room. Think of it like a series of safety deposit boxes in a bank. Other seed vaults throughout the world send their backup collections here. So do some private companies like DuPont and Monsanto. The room is kept at the same temperature as your home freezer. Fur-lined parkas hang on a rack just outside large gray metal doors.
Is it chilly inside?
Yeah, it is. You may want to put on a jacket, but it actually feels kind of good now that it's summertime.
To the right of the doors, a TV screen shows a live stream of the seed vault. It serves as another reminder of the building's security. In this place, you're always on camera.
Deep breath. We won't stay in here too long, but...
Inside, ceiling-high shelves hold seemingly endless rows of white pouches. In this room, there are 600,000 seed packets, which puts the total number of seeds in the billions. Some are here purely for storage, but researchers can also request seeds for studies.
And then they're all barcoded, so we know exactly where everything is.
That's another security measure. Looking at a seed pouch, there's nothing that tells you what kind of seeds you're holding, just a barcode. You need access to a secure database to find out what's inside. Downstairs, behind another series of heavy metal doors and under the watchful eye of security cameras, are long rows of stainless steel capsules. They're filled with liquid nitrogen to store seeds, livestock semen, and fish eggs.
We have anything from fish to cattle to sheep. We even do some cattle blood. But pretty much that's what we do so that we can put it in our big database and it's accessible and we know where it is.
Lab technician Angela Sosa is transferring Chinook salmon eggs from one container to another, placing them back into the liquid nitrogen. She's another of the handful of people with access to this room. The facility has been compared to Fort Knox in its level of security. But earlier this summer, that formidable reputation was thrown into question. For 7 years, this same vault kept about 1,500 pounds of Monsanto's genetically modified wheat seeds, including the same strain found growing in small patches in Oregon.
It would really be a rare case where we would keep another company's seed. There would have to be some kind of extenuating circumstances for them to say, we need you to keep this seed.
It's a rare occasion, but as in the Monsanto case, it does happen. Research leader Dave Dierig says he can't comment on the specifics of the Oregon case, as Department of Agriculture investigators are still trying to pin down the seed source. A department spokesman says all of Monsanto's wheat seeds held at the vault were incinerated 2 years ago at the request of the company. With the investigation turning in other directions, this beige building in Colorado can return to business as usual, securely storing the world's seeds. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. If you'd like to connect with us on Facebook, you can find 51%. You can find 51% there, and you can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.